It's a minute past eight on Wednesday, the 27th of November, and you're listening to Morning Ireland with Fran McNulty and Cathal McCullough.
The headlines. Figures today suggest that more and more people are facing the prospect of losing their homes. The first insolvency case involving a family with mortgage borrowings has come before the courts, and it's reported that the Irish woman at the centre of a slavery investigation in London is the daughter of a man who helped break the Enigma code used by the Nazis during World War II. Brian Jennings has the news in full.
Focus Ireland, which works with people who are homeless or are at risk of losing their homes, has recorded an 18% increase in the number of callers seeking help in the first 10 months of this year, compared to the same period last year. The charity has called for more effective measures to be put in place to protect people from being left on the streets. The findings will be presented to its annual conference in Dublin, which will be opened by the Minister of State for Housing and Planning, Jan O'Sullivan, this morning. Sharon Gagan reports.
So far this year, Focus Ireland has supported 9,237 people who are either homeless or at risk of losing their home, up from 7,819 during the same period last year, representing an 18% increase. The charity has also seen a 43% increase in the numbers seeking its housing advice services, up from 2,973 to 4,248 since last year. Ahead of its annual conference in Dublin today, Focus Ireland is calling for urgent action to stem family homelessness and to deliver affordable homes to those in need. The charity says more people are at serious risk of losing their homes due to the recession. In Dublin, the number of homeless families recently doubled from 8 to 16 every month, affecting nearly 200 children.
The first insolvency case involving a family with mortgage borrowings has come before the courts under the new system established to tackle the country's personal debt crisis. RT News has learned the case came before Trim Circuit Court last week, involving a family in the Leinster area with over €600,000 of borrowings. Our business editor David Murphy.
Until now, insolvency cases before the courts have not involved mortgage debt. However, this one does. The family's personal insolvency practitioner, Dungarvan-based Mitchell O'Brien, said he was confident of a successful deal. The borrowers have mortgages, unsecured debt and buy-to-let property. Last week, Judge Mary O'Malley Costello granted a protective certificate. That means there will be 70 days to negotiate an arrangement with seven creditors involved. The lenders would have to agree to a deal at a creditors' meeting, which is likely to happen before Christmas. It's expected this will result in a significant write-down of mortgage debt.
Germany's two main political parties reached agreement on forming a coalition government in the early hours of this morning. After talks lasting 17 hours, Chancellor Angela Merkel's Conservatives agreed terms with the central-left Social Democratic Party. 2 months after Chancellor Merkel's election victory, the agreement, if confirmed, would enable her to form a government next month. The 59-year-old Irish woman at the centre of a slavery investigation in London is reported to be the daughter of a man who helped to break a code used by the Nazis during World War II. The Daily Telegraph names the woman as 59-year-old Josephine Herivel and says she is the daughter of mathematician John Herivel, who was a key figure in the team who cracked the Enigma ciphers in 1940. She was educated in one of Northern Ireland's most prestigious second-level schools. Our Northern editor Tommy Gorman.
It was last week that allegations surfaced in London about a house where three women were for decades allegedly held against their will. Investigations are continuing and a man aged 73 and a 67-year-old woman have been questioned by the police. Today's Daily Telegraph is claiming that one of the women found in the house in Lambeth is Josephine Herivel, who is in her late 50s. This report emerged in British media hours after Scotland Yard again said it would not be naming those at the centre of the investigation. The Telegraph said Josephine Herivel is one of three daughters who were educated in Methodist College, Belfast, one of Northern Ireland's most famous schools. Her parents, John Herivel and Elizabeth Jones, had a remarkable background. During the Second World War, they were both at Bletchley Park, the British code-breaking centre in Buckinghamshire. Her father was one of the key figures in breaking the German Enigma ciphers. A native of Belfast, he returned home after the war and taught for a time at Campbell College before moving to Queen's University. He retired to Oxford in 1978, and his contribution to code-breaking only became widely known in the years immediately before his death in 2011. In her late teens, according to the Daily Telegraph, Josephine Herivel was known as a talented musician, but friends lost contact with her after she moved to London in the 1970s. Tommy Gorman, RTÉ News, Belfast.
The British Prime Minister David Cameron has said the European Union needs to restrict the right of its people to work in whichever country they choose. He said there's deep concern about how many people may come to Britain from Bulgaria and Romania when restrictions are lifted in January. Mr. Cameron sets out details of new measures to make it harder for EU migrants to claim benefits if they move to Britain. He says out-of-work benefits will not be paid until a migrant has been in the UK for at least 3 months. Migrants will have to prove they're working and won't be able to claim housing benefits straight away. Beggars and people sleeping rough will be deported and barred from returning for a year. 150 jobs are to be generated in County Mayo by a company providing health services. Northgate says the positions will more than double its workforce in Ireland. Our Western correspondent Pat McGrath.
Northgate is a private company specialising in the delivery of public services. It operates a newborn hearing screening programme for the HSE in maternity hospitals and runs computer file management systems for several other hospitals. The company plans to create 150 positions over the next 3 years at a new facility in County Mayo. A final location is yet to be chosen, but it's understood the firm will set up in an existing premises in the Castlebar area. The jobs will be in the information technology sector. There will also be a number of support roles for existing services provided by the company here. Recruitment is expected to begin early next year. Pat McGrath, RTÉ News, Galway.
Now the time is coming up to 8 minutes past eight.
Late, it's time for the papers again from Clodagh Walsh.
We're talking hundreds of millions on the front of two of the papers this morning. The Examiner reports that local authorities across the country have been forced to write off at least €500 million in commercial rates over the course of the recession as businesses collapse under the weight of their debts. While the Irish Times reports that the HSE says that worst case scenario, its deficit for this year could be close to €300 million, double the Minister for Health's estimate of €150 million. In correspondence seen by the paper, the Director General of the HSE warned that the €300 million figure could rise and maybe a fall in tax for hard-pressed working families. In an interview in the Irish Independent, the Thánaiste said that as the economy picks up, he felt it might be possible to ease the tax burden on working people. No specific promises, though. And there appears to be no easing of austerity for many families. That's according to the findings from the Growing Up in Ireland study, which is published today. The Times says the study notes the financial difficulties experienced by families have been both pervasive and persistent. In relation to health, the report found that 15% of five-year-old children are overweight and 5% are obese. Most of the papers this morning have details of the latest findings from that study. And many of them carry photos of the Irish woman who was allegedly held as a slave in London for 30 years. As you heard in the bulletin, she's reported to be the daughter of a man who helped break the Enigma code used by the Nazis during World War II. This story makes the lead for the Herald. The continuing controversy over top-up payments paid to senior staff and health agencies is the lead for the Irish Daily Mail. Elsewhere in that paper, it says that ESB workers have been told they should forfeit their 55% discount on home electricity and other work-related benefits if they go on strike. Meanwhile, The Independent reports that manufacturing companies are asking staff to work additional shifts over the next fortnight so they can meet pre-Christmas orders in the event of a strike at the ESB. A quiet funeral for a brave man the big boys could not bury. That's the headline over a piece by Miriam Lord in The Times, writing about the funeral yesterday of property developer Tom Gilmartin, a key witness at the Mahon Tribunal. She says he had done the state some service and undone some preening servants of the state in the process. Both the Mail and the Examiner write of how Mr. Gilmartin's son spoke of the family's sadness that he never got the apology they felt he was owed by the state. On their front pages, the Irish Sun, the Independent and the Examiner all carry a photo of Nigella Lawson. The Sun, leading with the story about the chef, reports that her husband Charles Saatchi has accused her of taking cocaine. The accusation came to light during a court case in which the couple's former personal assistants are accused of committing fraud. The lead in the Irish Daily Star reports that the pilot of a plane carrying Manchester United players had to abort landing the plane just 400 metres above the ground because another plane was on the ground as they came in to land. And there's lots of Christmassy features in the papers. It's all about the Christmas jumper in the Examiner. The Times talks to some well-known people about their best Christmas present ever. For Francis Fitzgerald, Minister for Children, it was skates, the old chunky metal variety. And finally, to the business section of the Independent. Next to a financial report from the luxury jeweller retailer Tiffany's, there's a great black and white photo of actors taking a break during the filming of Breakfast at Tiffany's near the store in New York in 1961. Audrey Hepburn and George Peppard included.
Clodagh, thank you for that.
Now, a lot has been reported about the background to this alleged case of slavery lasting 30 years in London, including the name and Northern Irish origins, and indeed a brief piece of film footage of one of the three women thought to have been held. Our Northern editor, Tommy Gorman, joins us. Tommy, reports are one thing, facts are another. Is there anything we can say is definitely true about what we're hearing about these women and this apparently Northern Irish woman in particular?
Not 100%, Cathal. This is an extraordinary story, and so far not all of the dots are joined up. Say, for instance, we know that there was a lot of briefing done in relation to what is alleged to have taken place in a house in London, in Lambeth, but the police at this stage have not interviewed in detail the number of people they say were rescued from it. And last night, although pictures and details of one of the women supposed to be from Ireland who was rescued from this house began to circulate, the police put out a statement saying they would not be naming any of the people involved in their investigation so far. And I noticed that the BBC has taken heed of that police warning, but there have been so many details published, say, by reputable newspapers like the Daily Telegraph, and indeed there have been pictures on ITN last night too.
Well, now, the Daily Telegraph has named one of the women involved, who they say is Northern Irish, Josephine Herivel. So what are they saying about her?
Well, Josephine Herivel has a remarkable background. She is, we believe, 57. And what's extraordinary about her is her family background. If she is who the Daily Telegraph says she is, well, she's the daughter of a very, very famous World War II hero, a man called John Herivel. He was a mathematician who became involved in the team in Bletchley Park in Buckinghamshire, who became involved in cracking the German Enigma ciphers in 1940. His background was that he was born in Northern Ireland. He was the son of a civil servant. He went to a very famous school here in Belfast, Methodist College. He won a scholarship to an English university. He went over there and then he was given a job working in Bletchley Park, and he did that very, very important work. He moved back to Northern Ireland after the war. He worked in another very famous second-level school, Campbell College. He then went on to work in Queen's University, and he was on the staff there until 1978 when he retired and moved to Oxford. And he became a fellow of one of the famous colleges in Oxford. And he died in 2011. And actually, he was such an understated genius that, he didn't really start talking about his work in Bletchley Park until the late 1990s. And he published a book in 2008. He died in 2011. And he has become so famous for that role in code breaking.
So what's known about the daughter and indeed his family?
Well, there are reports suggesting that he had three daughters, although in the obituaries after John Herivel died, there's only mention of two of the daughters. But the reports suggest that he had this third daughter, who is Josephine Herivel. She actually, according to the reports, she went to school in Methodist College, second level school, Methodist College in Belfast. And then she moved to London in the 1970s, and friends from Northern Ireland had no trace of her since then. The other two daughters are both living in the United Kingdom, one close to London and one some distance from it. But there were these three daughters of this very, very famous man. And indeed, his wife had worked, she was called Elizabeth Jones. She had worked at Bletchley Park as well. And father and mother married in 1947. But some of the, I suppose, intriguing elements of this story, Cathal, the police are putting out these health warnings about the identities of the people. The police, it would seem, have not interviewed in detail the main characters involved in this story to date. And yet you have all these background briefings emerging and taking place, I suppose, these background briefings about what did or what did not happen in this house. So I think a lot of the facts of this story have yet to emerge, and we don't actually know where is it going to end up.
Tommy Gorman of Belfast, thank you.
It looks like forming a grand coalition in Germany might be over the finishing line. Talks on the new government have been ongoing since the election in September, and it could take a few weeks more to form a government. Quentin Peel, outgoing Financial Times Berlin correspondent, is on the line. Good morning, Quentin.
Morning.
We're used to coalitions in this country. The process tends to be somewhat quicker than in Germany. Just why has it taken so long?
Well, it's partly a ritual, and it's partly that actually it was a hell of a difficult process, because these are, after all, the two great enemies of German politics, the Christian Democrats and the Social Democrats. But there is an element of ritual, and that is that it had to look difficult because the Social Democrats don't want to do it, and they've got to persuade their own members to vote for this deal. So if it had looked easy, I don't think their members would like it at all. As it is, it's no certain thing that the membership will vote for the deal in the end of the day.
Martin Schulz, the President of the European Parliament, has called it an excellent result. How excellent a government are they likely to make?
It's very difficult to say. I think the problem here is that the outcome of the German election, which after all was more than 2 months ago now, was a very clear victory for Angela Merkel. She was just 5 seats short of an absolute majority. So she's going to be very much the dominating force in this grand coalition, and that makes it very uncomfortable for the Social Democrats. And as I say, they're going to put it to a membership now who, according to the opinion polls, are about 65% opposed to having a grand coalition with Angela Merkel. So it's absolutely no done deal until we see it. And if it does come about, then it could collapse again in 2 years' time if they can't agree on something important.
That is, if the deal is done, as you say, and there is a likelihood it may not be approved. If that were to happen, where is Germany then?
Well, then Angela Merkel will have to turn to her only other option for forming a coalition, which is to the Greens. That would be a very interesting government, a Green Christian Democrat government. But I think most people think that it's actually premature, that the Greens are not ready to do a deal with the Christian Democrats, and so those talks might well fail. If they failed, then what happens in Germany is that the state president will convene the Bundestag, the parliament, and say, well, Frau Merkel, let's see if you can get a majority. And if enough opposition people did defect and supported her because they didn't want new elections, it's just possible she could end up in a minority government. And if that does fail, then they'll have new elections.
You talk about Angela Merkel's party having the most dominant aspect, and her leadership being pretty dominant as well. But the Social Democrats are going to want to have a pretty significant say in what this coalition may do as well, are they not?
Yes, absolutely. And the balance of the coalition is, if anything, slightly to the left of centre, in spite of the fact that this was a right-of-centre victory in the election. And that's the irony of the situation. Before the elections happened, during the summer, it was pretty obvious that German voters actually wanted this outcome. More than half of German voters said they liked the idea of a grand coalition. It suited them in Germany to feel this was a great centre, government of the centre. Well, actually, as these negotiations have dragged on, and if you like, there's been more and more token gestures made to the Social Democrats, the whole idea has got less and less popular. So now it's really not the most popular solution. And that's, I think, conservative voters who are saying, we don't really like the idea of having a rather left-wing government. I mean, just to give you one example, the biggest token policy that the SPD has won has been to get a statutory minimum wage in Germany. That's something that the right in Germany has never wanted.
Just also, there is an issue, and is there, I suppose, are German people conscious that almost all of Europe is on a form of a standstill waiting for this election to happen? And we've been hearing about that for weeks now.
Yeah, it's been a funny situation because the truth is, the new German government, let's take the European situation, the new German government is not going to be significantly different to the old in terms of its specific policies. The negotiations on banking union, for example, the German position really isn't going to change very much. So everybody's been waiting for a new German government, partly because they were hoping for some different answers from Berlin, and I don't think they're going to get them. They're going to get, fundamentally, an Angela Merkel policy of step-by-step pro-European, but we're defending the national interest too.
Just in conclusion, Quentin, government by Christmas?
Yes, I think the 17th of December is D-Day for that vote in the Bundestag. We'll have the referendum in the Social Democrats first, and then Angela Merkel will see if she's got her majority.
All right, Quentin Peel in Berlin, thank you for speaking to us this morning. The first case under the new insolvency regime involving a family with mortgage borrowings has now come to light. Our business editor David Murphy is here and can tell us more. David, what do we know?
Well, this is a family with around €600,000 of debt. There was a case in Trim District Court last week where they were given a protective certificate. That means that they will have 70 days to negotiate with their creditors. We know that there are seven creditors involved and that they have a personal insolvency practitioner called Mitchell O'Brien. I spoke to him last night and he said that he is confident of a successful outcome, and there'll be a creditors meeting likely before Christmas. So I think that the thing about this is that so far the only deals that are before the courts, with the exception of this one, are involving debts other than mortgage debt. And we know that there are 98,000 mortgage counts in arrears. And the key issue with all of this was that with this system, which was established by the Irish government, it was the first time ever that there was an insolvency system set up which included dealing with mortgage debt. The other systems in the developed world don't. They deal with other types of debt like credit card debt or credit union debt. So what we're now seeing is the first of these cases to try to resolve the issue of mortgage debt coming before the courts, which is very significant. And I think that the outcome of that case will be closely looked at.
David, is this a case of somebody who has a mortgage on a home they live in, or is there a buy-to-let involved? Do we have that level of detail?
Well, we only have fairly vague detail, but there is a buy-to-let involved and there is a commitment to sell assets as part of any deal. As we know, we did have the outcome of the first deal under the insolvency system earlier this week, and my understanding is that the write-off in that case was in excess of 70%. But this situation is likely to be different because what we're seeing is that if, for instance, you have someone who has a significant mortgage and the mortgage is much larger than the value of the home, the mortgage can only be written down to the value of the home. It can't be written down any further, for instance. So that would mean if there's a €200,000 debt on a family home and the family home is now worth €100,000, the most it can be written down to is the market value of the property. So I think for many people, while they heard a very large figure earlier this week, for many individuals, they won't be getting a deal of that type of extent in terms of the write down in value of mortgage debt on the family home.
You mentioned a protection certificate. This effectively means that these people are insulated somewhat from the people they owe money to for a period of time, and there will be a creditors meeting. How much detail will we get arising out of that? Because people, David, will be very interested to see what an ordinary mortgage holder and somebody with a buy-to-let, what sort of a write down they might achieve.
Well, we don't really know exactly what the borrower in this case will be happy with, but in terms of the types of information which will be made publicly available, it's going to be very, very limited. Ultimately, all we're really going to see is the name of the borrowers and the perhaps dates and times of when they received any type of deal being published on the website of the Insolvency Services of Ireland. It won't say how much debt is involved. It won't say what sort of write-down has been achieved, and it won't identify the creditors. But I think that what we should begin to be able to get a sense of from the personal insolvency practitioners around the country is what types of deals are being done. And in a sense, one of the ideas behind this system is that when creditors and when borrowers can see what's actually happening, when people go into this legal structure and they see what types of deals are being done, well, then it gives them some sort of indication what could actually happen outside of that. And it'll force many banks and borrowers to come to some sort of arrangement, because they'll know exactly what's going on within insolvency. And I think the insolvency service will be quite comfortable with that too.
Also, David, in this whole area, but separate to personal insolvency, some changes coming online with regard to bankruptcy, which will be welcomed by many.
That's right. Well, what's happening next week, Fran, is that there are the final leg of this whole insolvency situation is going to come into force, and that is the new bankruptcy regime, which is going to reduce the term of bankruptcy from 12 to 3 years. But I understand that today there are going to be amendments to the Bankruptcy Act, which will be announced in the Senedd. And what that's going to mean is that the cost of going into bankruptcy is going to be reduced. At the moment, it costs around €1,450. That's going to be cut to €750. And the reason for that cut is that at the moment there is a requirement that people going into bankruptcy have their details published in the Irish Oifigeal publication and in a national newspaper. But that's going to change under this, so their details only have to be published on the website of the Insolvency Service of Ireland, and that's going to reduce those costs for heavily indebted individuals.
All right, David Murphy, your business editor, thank you for bringing us those details. You're with Morning Ireland. Darren's back with sport.
Fran, good morning to you. Celtic crashed out of the Champions League last night following a 3-0 defeat at home to AC Milan. Goals from Kaká, Zapata and Balotelli gave the Italians a comfortable win. There was a big shock in the group's other game. Ajax overcame Barcelona by 2-1. But Barcelona still on top of that group. They have 10 points. Milan are 2 points further behind on 8. Ajax a point further back in third. And the bad news for Celtic, they're bottom on 3 points and they'll be staying there. They won't even qualify for the Europa League. Neil Lennon is the Celtic manager.
Tonight has been symptomatic of our campaign. We've missed good chances. I'm really disappointed with the 2 goals we've conceded from corners, because we, you know, take a lot of pride in that. And I think it's the first time for a long time someone scored direct header from a corner. At 1-1, game could have went either way. And then we go and concede again from a corner. And that's been the most disappointing aspect, as has the opportunities we've missed.
Yeah, they missed lots of opportunities. Soft goals too. Joined on the line by Pat Nevin. Pat, what went wrong last night?
Just about everything that could go wrong, sadly, for Celtic. If Celtic are going to get past these top teams in Europe, even though AC Milan aren't doing the greatest at the moment, if they're going to get past the top teams, Celtic have to be at their very best in their game. Every player has to be at their best. Tactically, it has to go perfectly well as well. And obviously, they want the other team to be not to play their best. But I think, actually, AC Milan actually played very well last night. They're good players, like Kaká played well. And in the end, see, when you look at it, you know, if you look at the amount of money that Celtic can spend on players and compare that to Milan, compare that to Barcelona, well, there is no comparison. It's so far apart. Celtic, for me, are a very, very good side that maximise their potential a lot of the time. But if you have to sell probably the guts of your team, you know, the centre-forward, the centre-back, the centre- or midfield player, and during the summer there, and then try and rebuild again very quickly for the Champions League, you're always going to be up against it. So even though they're out, I actually feel really sorry for Neil Lennon, who has to rebuild every single year.
Well, he said as much in his interview last night. He said he's building towards next season, but not to even qualify for the Europa League. How big a blow is that to have no Europe whatsoever?
I mean, financially it's a big blow. I think morally it's a big blow for them as well. I think for Scottish football it's a really painful one, because everyone knows who's going to win the league in Scotland this season. So that's slightly boring. And that excitement that was brought by European football that Celtic brought and have done quite regularly over the last number of years, well, that's gone now. So it all does look a little bit dull, and it's up to, you know, to find something else, you know, going forward from that. So all those things are bad. It also has a negative effect on Neil Lennon's buying power for, you know, the next season and the season after that. So that's not good either. There are lots of negatives out there. The thing is, I wouldn't blame Neil. I wouldn't necessarily even blame Celtic Football Club, because they're stuck in a place where they can't spend money. And if you're going to get through in the Champions League year in, year out, year in, year out, have a look at the people who do it every year. They've got a few quid.
Interesting points, Pat Nevin. Thanks as always. Chelsea beaten 1-0 away to Basel. Steaua Bucharest played out a scoreless draw with Schalke. That result means Chelsea will qualify for the last 16 despite the defeat. Arsenal almost certain to make the knockout stages. They had a 2-0 win over Marseille. Borussia Dortmund beat Napoli 3-1, so the Gunners would need to lose 3-0 away to the Italians in the remaining game to miss out on qualification. Elsewhere, Zenit drew 1-1 with Atletico Madrid, and Porto ended 1-1 against Austria Vienna. Now, Manchester United's game away to Bayer Leverkusen is the live match on RTÉ Radio and television this evening. David Moyes and his squad suffered a little scare on their way to Germany yesterday. I'm joined on the line by RTÉ commentator George Hamilton. What happened, George?
Yeah, they were coming into land apparently in Cologne, and it said there was an aircraft on the runway, so they had to do what they call a go-around. It's not very nice when you're on the aircraft and you're slowing down to come in and touch down, and then all of a sudden there's that great whoosh as the engines are put on full throttle and you roar back up into the air again. But that aircraft are built to do that, just that kind of thing. It's scary if you're on the plane, but they weren't really in any danger. They got down, and I'm sure they'll be over it by the time kickoff comes.
Okay, Georgia, on the field, it's a big game for them. I know they're unbeaten, I think, in 10 games, but maybe their form is a bit up and down, but they can qualify for the knockout stages tonight, can't they?
Yes, they can. It's an interesting one too, because if Shakhtar don't win their match against Real Sociedad, then both United and Leverkusen will go through with a draw. So it's quite an interesting setup, really. And if Leverkusen win, they go through. So it's nicely poised for both teams. I think Manchester United, as you said about Arsenal, are relatively safe. The last match coming up, of course, and they have to get through that. But they do look like they're going to qualify, which is a great achievement for David Moyes in his opening season in charge of them. Two draws away from home against a team that, interestingly, has won its last eight Champions League qualifying group stage matches at home. And they're the team, of course, who knocked out Manchester United famously in 2002 when Alex Ferguson was desperate to get to the final, because it was at Hampden Park. That was the final in which Zidane scored the wonder goal for Real, and Leverkusen were beaten. So they have a bit of pedigree. They're second in the Bundesliga, just 4 points behind Bayern Munich. It won't be a cakewalk for Manchester United by any means, and they may not qualify tonight, and Leverkusen may. But I think overall, in answer to your question, United are on the way to the knockout stages.
And a prediction in a word for us?
A prediction is that I think it might well end up as a draw, because it's been two draws for Moyes already. A draw or a Leverkusen win. I don't think United are going to get it all their own way tonight.
Okay, George. Well, you can hear George and the rest of the team on RTÉ2 television tonight. The game also live on 2FM's Game On. Full list of all tonight's fixtures on the RTÉ website. In a bit of rugby news, Ulster are hoping Rory Best will return to action in mid to late January following a successful operation on his broken arm. Fergal O'Brien has beaten Alex Davies 6-2 in the first round of the UK Championship in York. And finally, there's racing this evening at the all-weather track in Dundalk. The action gets underway at 5:45.
Industrial action at the ESB is looking more and more likely, but unions in the company are due to begin talks this week aimed at avoiding the action. It centres around pensions for ESB workers, a hole in the pension fund, and changes in the way the scheme works. There have been claims from the ESB group of unions that some workers could end up with pensions of only €13 per week. Unite is the largest union in the ESB. Richie Brown of the union is on the line. Good morning to you.
Good morning, Fran.
Do you believe this line that some workers could end up with €13 a week of a pension?
Absolutely, Fran. The first thing to say is just to remind your listeners that the ESB workers are unique in the sense that by virtue of the fact that they were forced to join the ESB pension scheme, that denies them any entitlement from the state for a state pension. So in the event of their retirement, workers in ESB get no state pension entitlement. Therefore, their only source of income in retirement is their ESB pension. And given the fact that under the minimum funding standard, there's a 1.6 billion deficit in the ESB pension scheme,
Which the company has said they will address by 2018.
No, well, they haven't actually said that they'll address it by 2018. What the ESB have said is this in their annual accounts. First of all, they have dishonestly and inaccurately described their pension scheme, which is a defined benefit pension scheme. They have described that in their accounts as a defined contribution scheme, and they have qualified that further by also stating in their accounts that it is the ESB's intention not to put any further monies into the pension scheme in any circumstances whatsoever. So they have quite clearly indicated that in the event of there being a deficit in the scheme, that they have effectively washed their hands and walk away from any obligation, okay, responsibility, or liability they have to the scheme, and they have placed all of the risk upon the ESB workers, and that is what the issue is.
Okay, well, what most people this morning are concerned about, Richard Brown, is whether their lights will go out between now and Christmas. What form of industrial action is Unite considering?
Well, the first thing to say is if any action will be taken at all, it will be by and large determined by the company's response to us when we meet
now,
them
what,
tomorrow.
What form could that action take?
Now, the form of action, the group of unions will elect or nominate a disputes or a strike committee, and it's up to those elected representatives to decide, in the event of a dispute and in the event of any industrial action taken, what form the action will take and the duration and length of that action.
You know the company and your workers pretty well. What type of action could be considered?
What I will say is this. This affects all workers in the ESB. It's not a small group, grade or category of workers, or it's not in a specific location or business unit. This is right across the ESB, and it affects all workers in the ESB pension scheme. Given the fact that when we balloted our members, we got over an 87% vote in favour of industrial action. So given that overwhelming mandate, given the depth of feeling and the fact that all workers in the ESB are affected by this, even if workers in the ESB take some form of limited industrial action, short of an all-out strike, I have no doubt that that will cause huge disruption to the service and will result in power outages.
You would say that most definitely if industrial action goes ahead, there will be power outages?
Even limited industrial action, given, as I said, the number of staff involved, the depth of feeling of our members, that even if there is action taken short of an all-out strike, that will invariably end up in widespread disruption to the service.
Why has the ESB group of unions waited until a few weeks before Christmas to raise this issue?
Well, we haven't. We've been raising this issue with the company for a year and a half.
Why bring it to a head now, though?
To no avail. Well, we've been raising it for a year and a half with the company, and if writing strongly worded letters to the company and to ministers could have resolved this, it would have been resolved long ago, because we've tried that to no avail. And if marching and demonstrating and protesting could have resolved this, that would have done also, but because we've tried that and to no avail. And the fact of the matter is that we engaged in a process in terms with our members, and due to the 1990 Industrial Relations Act and the fact that we had to ballot over the period of time, the length of time it has taken to ballot and to consult with our members, and the time frame involved, if you like, left us with effectively serving strike notice this Friday.
It's not just about maximum impact, you know?
Well, it's not. No, we didn't sit down 2 years ago and decide, let's have a strike in the ESB at Christmas in 2013. Wouldn't that be great? The timing of this dispute is of the company's making. It wasn't of our choosing. Okay. And the timeline and the time frame of this, quite clearly, as long as and with the responsibility, lies fairly and squarely with the company.
All right, okay. Richie Brown of Unite, thank you for talking to us this morning. We did ask the ESB to come on the programme, but they said they didn't want to get in the way of delegate talks, which are about to get underway.
The Central African Republic, as its name suggests, is in the middle of Africa. It's about 10 times the size of Ireland, population 4.5 million. Living in what's becoming a very dangerous place to live. UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon last week proposed sending an 11,000 strong force there if the situation got worse. Now, that was last week. Yesterday, the UN's Assistant Secretary General responsible for Africa, Jan Eliasson, said the country was descending into complete chaos, with violence threatening to spread into neighbouring states as well. Prompt and decisive action was needed, he said, and he explained why.
There is certainly a sense of urgency, and there is all the reason to sound the alarm. We have so many reports of massacres, of rapes, of summary executions, child soldiers being recruited that we felt, the Secretary General and I, that we needed to raise the level of attention and bring the matter to an urgent call to the Security Council of the United Nations. And the reactions already yesterday at the Security Council were positive, and I'm rather sure we will see a resolution very soon.
And that's the UN's Assistant Secretary General, Jan Eliasson, speaking overnight. I asked the Guardian's Africa correspondent, David Smith, how the situation in the Central African Republic had become so serious.
It's been a long history of chaos and coups in the Central African Republic, really since it gained independence in 1960. The president has rarely had any control beyond the capital. In that context, this is yet another crisis, but one of the most serious. There was another coup in March when the president fled by helicopter. He was ousted by a rebel coalition. A new man took over, the first Muslim president of the country. But he himself has not really been able to keep control of the rebels who brought him to power. And now, frankly, they're just running riots across the country, acting with impunity. Lawlessness prevails, and they're burning villages, they're looting, sometimes just for economic gain, sometimes it seems just because they've grown up in a culture of violence and it's what they do. And unfortunately, now it's dividing along sectarian lines. The rebels are mainly Muslim, and they have Muslim allies from Sudan and Chad helping them, and that is alienating the majority Christian population, who in turn are taking up arms and committing some atrocities of their own. So it is becoming a spiral of violence.
In the lawless and very unstable situation that you describe, we know there are just over 2,000 African peacekeeping troops there, with more on the way. The French are sending 1,000, and the UN is talking about sending up to 11,000. We don't know when or in what circumstances. How urgent is the need?
Extremely urgent, I think, particularly because people are starting to bandy around words like genocide and civil war, which are very incendiary, and they push a lot of buttons. And I think the point is that we're not there yet. It's not yet a genocide, but it could be. So really, every day matters. This is the world's great opportunity to do what it failed to do in Rwanda, and actually step in and knit this situation in the bud. And in that sense, it's all still to play for. Every day that passes, more people are dying. So it's a very urgent situation indeed. And the current peacekeeping operation there is very small on manpower, and it's a very tough task to bring order to a country that's bigger than France in landmass.
You described the Central African Republic in your piece, having been to that country recently, as never much more than a phantom state. Is the situation retrievable? Is it so unstable that it maybe could be beyond the capacity of any force, military or otherwise, to bring it back to something resembling a normal country?
I think it's certainly comparable with Afghanistan and Somalia, and those kind of situations where, you're talking about a very long-term investment and commitment. Indeed, outside the capital, really very few institutions, very few structures. And right now, things you would take for granted, like an army, a police force, have virtually disappeared, and it's a free-for-all. However, I think, unlike the Taliban in Afghanistan or al-Shabaab in Somalia, these Seleka rebels are more defeatable. They're not very well organized. They're not particularly well armed. A substantial peacekeeping force could at least win militarily. And the other sign of hope is that, the Christian Muslim division is relatively new. It's not as if it's an age-old enmity. And some voices there certainly feel that it could be healed. But indeed, then you do have the job of effectively building a nation from scratch, still really clearing up the mess that the French left behind more than half a century ago. And there's no doubt that will require a lot of money and a lot of commitment for a country that, quite frankly, you know, many people would still struggle to find on the map.
David Smith of The Guardian speaking to me earlier. Irish Christmas trees are in demand abroad. Exports by the truckload were here in the last 10 days and in the next 10. And around 400,000 Christmas trees will be sold here, with growers hard at work, both on supplies and on security. Joe McGreely reports.
It's first light in Carnew, County Wicklow, and workers are heading out amongst the trees on Porter's Christmas tree farm. For days now, they have been getting up early and finishing after dark, as the intensive Christmas tree harvesting period is underway. Standing amongst the harvesters, farm owner Peter Porter says growing good trees takes time and year-round effort.
It's not just 3 weeks of Christmas. A lot of some of those trees on our left-hand side are now, they're 8-year-old, and the trees here that you're looking at here now are 6-year-old, like 5 to 6-year-old, like, so it's a long, hard battle, like, to get them to where they are. Like, there's no easy money.
Three people are employed throughout the year on this farm. They plant, shape and tend to the trees and the site, while a team of 10 are now employed to cut, net and load the trees for shipment to market. Among them, Henry Hatton, who skillfully uses a teleporter to load 9-foot pallets of Christmas trees onto a lorry trailer.
About 70 goes into the palletizer, depending on the size of the trees. And they're fairly tight, are you getting them in? They're full height and full length of the trailer.
These days are so busy, Henry and his fellow workers don't even leave the farm for meals.
Start at 7:45 and finish 5:30 or so. We have here 10 o'clock at tea, and usually around 12:30 for dinner time, depending on how you go on today.
Busy all day?
Very, yeah. Sleep at night, so you would.
And once the last pallet is loaded on this particular trailer, paperwork is completed and the truck departs for the ferry and its ultimate destination, a garden centre chain in the London area. Around 300,000 Christmas trees are exported from Ireland every year to the UK, France, Germany and other EU countries. 400,000 are sold at home in the 5 weeks up to Christmas. Intense demand has led to theft of trees in the past. So out there amongst those trees is a caravan where security personnel keep watch all night. Peter Porter again.
Some people have security company coming in, and some farmers, people or growers are doing it themselves, like, so they are, like, or have the workers doing it, like, I mean, so it's very hard, like, I mean, that you have to mind your product. So we have a presence at this farm 24 hours. So we have.
Dermot Page is the chairman of the Irish Christmas Tree Growers Association.
We're very conscious on security. We've done a hell of a lot over the last few years to get everyone's attention up about security. We've got security personnel on all night. We've got the guards involved. They've been very, very helpful this year in particular, doing a lot of stops and also helicopter patrols around this area in Wicklow.
The average tree sells wholesale for between 15 and 30 euro. Add 20 or 30 more for the retail price. So I asked Dermot why choose a real tree rather than an artificial one.
Well, we feel that there are huge benefits to the real tree. It is great for the environment. It's a sustainable product. For every tree that is harvested, there's a tree planted. It's got a lovely smell. It's a real part of the tradition of Christmas.
And that was Joe McGreely reporting on what is obviously a very healthy Christmas tree market, but also one that has to be watched.